welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ailey Packham, and we are being transmitted into your world thanks to Flowers Unlimited. Well then, did you know that Manchester United lost on Sunday? Well, if you've been listening to the mainstream media, you'll know all about it, but maybe not who administered that defeat. The good news is, we're here to tell you about just how good Brighton were and how we did the double over the red side of Manchester and made it 3 wins out of 3 at Old Trafford. It also made it 3 wins in a week as we extended our unbeaten run to 7 heading into this weekend's game with Everton. Also this week, we have said goodbye to Jakob Moda, who has moved to Feyenoord. And with just over a week of the January window still to go, will we see any more movement in or out? Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wears, and we are delighted to welcome back the man with all the news. It's the Argus' chief sports writer, Brian Owen. Brian, you've had a busy week.
Yeah, back in Sussex now, and all driving as well. I do try and get the train when I can for these away games, but they just didn't work out for various reasons. But
you mean train strikes and...
I'm trying to think what the reasons were. Partly it's deadlines and, you know, getting back and say a Sunday when I've got to work on the next day's newspaper. So it's not just strikes and it's a combination of reasons. But no, I quite enjoyed the drive in. Remember to pay for the Dartford Tunnel. And I can't remember a week like that. I must admit, I can remember 3 away games in a week and a bit, wasn't it? But that 3 wins, I can't remember. And I suspect.
Yeah, I saw your piece. You're referring back to League One days.
But I don't even know if that happened. I tweeted that and said it must have happened. But 3 away in a week, I'm not even sure it did, because I was thinking about that March when they won 8 games in March.
Yeah.
But I doubt if, I haven't bothered looking it up, I doubt if 3 in a row were away. And I missed half that month anyway, because I was away. But but 3 away wins, and I know none of them in isolation, none of them were against great sides. I still think Old Trafford, will come onto that, has got something, still got a certain aura to it. But it when you add in, you know, where they come from and the injuries and the accumulation of the whole thing, the 3 wins was, you know, it was really good. And
well, it was, because going into the week, there was a lot of doom and gloom around the place, because obviously we weren't particularly losing. It was still on an unbeaten run. But we weren't picking up the wins, which we probably deserved to do. And people were getting very, very frustrated. So to go to Norwich and actually, you know, even, you know, we go 2-0 up now, we're still nervous.
Yeah.
So to put 4 past Norwich and then to go to Ipswich and you know, it was a good Ipswich side. I mean, Bart was probably the busier of the two goalkeepers, really.
Yeah, fair enough. In the first half, he was, wasn't he? But the second half in both those two league games was really impressive. And I think also signs of what was to come with the draw at Villa, which I really enjoyed, actually, that game and that trip, and the Arsenal game. And I just thought there was a disappointment about those amongst quite a lot of people because of what had gone beforehand. If you looked at those in isolation, they were decent enough, but they weren't enough to overturn the ongoing disappointment from previous matches. But I know we want to move on to Old Trafford anyway.
I was just about to say, I mean, we have an hour, Brian. I just think everything, and I said this before on the show, everything is in context. We drew at home against Brentford, against Nottingham Forest. I mean, that in hindsight looks like a good result. But these were games that we could and should have won. And they still ended up with a point. We then draw against Arsenal, we draw against Villa, same result, same outcome, same scoreline. But everything's in context. You think, well, those are points, a point gained in each case rather than the other ones where they're 2 lost.
Yeah.
And in all of those cases, well, certainly probably more the games against the lower clubs, they were 2 points dropped in as much as we should and could have cleaned up and gone home on 70 minutes with the points wrapped up. Yeah. But, you know, you could also then say, well, we could have won against Arsenal. We could have won against Villa. It's just the nature of football. But you're right, Brian, the Villa game and the Arsenal game, it's not as though we'd turned bad. We just, they'd run out of ideas up front. They were looking a little bit lost. We saw bits of that against Ipswich as well. first half, plenty of possession, plenty of movement, and absolutely no idea up front in the first half. Second half, different thing entirely, which then begs the question, and I'll throw this open as a hypothetical to anyone here, is what are we going to be like when we can actually play two second halves in one game and be that good?
Well, there is that. But I mean, the other thing is going that previous run, Brian, was I kind of think we'd forgotten how to win. And I think the players were beginning to feel that a little bit because, you know, when 2-0 up going into the 86th minute at Leicester, still drawing, 2-0 up against Wolves, still drawing. It's, you know, taking the lead against Villa, drawing, you know, so getting that win at Norwich was a massive, massive, like, fill-up to the players. And it, you know, and it builds belief. This is how you do it. And then to take that into the next game, and again, like Al says, I mean, we've generally this season, we've been pretty much a second-half team. We haven't really hit our straps early in any games, apart from the one we're about to talk about, strangely. But it's
just the Norwich game came along at the perfect moment. The team had stopped losing and playing a championship side in the FA Cup was just the boost they need. They out-muscled, they out-fought, they out-manoeuvred a championship side, a decent championship side, but a championship side nonetheless, stuck four away. And you come away from that thinking, yes, it's a championship side, but hey, we've played Norwich in recent years and we've come unstuck against them. So this, we're not talking about rubbish here, but to get a cool and breezy 4-0 win, you can see it put some wind in their sails, if you excuse my double sailing metaphor there. But and they took it on to Ipswich and took it on to Manchester United. And I hope that, you know, Everton's bounce isn't too much of a bounce this weekend.
We're only talking about rowing again this week. Not
oh, OK, it. Yeah, come back to that.
Sorry, I keep getting messages from a bloke in Paraguay and a bloke in Ipswich, but this isn't live, is it? So people know about that, I guess, by the time this all comes out. So just think about what you're saying. Yeah, Norwich did come at quite a good time. Getting into games, starting games slowly and growing into them, it almost feels like games that they've had to do that have been, on quite a few occasions, the better games and games that they've started well, e.g. Chelsea away, Liverpool away. Quite often they've started games well and not built on it. So, yeah, the complete 90 minutes would be good to see. But Hertzler spoke about the wins, just the confidence. I know he's all this. It's not much about the results. It's about the process, et cetera, et cetera. But he did mention after those two games in East Anglia, the wins, they give confidence, don't they? And they just sort of reinforce that what you're doing is the right thing.
I mean, the process is one thing, and what you're trying to do is ultimately win a game. Now, yes, you can win a game badly or not play as well as you could do, and you think, well, what are you going to learn from that? But if you do play well and do win, you think, well, this is the way to do it. Because if you know you haven't played that well, you fear, and as you're talking about that word confidence, the confidence doesn't come up. If the players themselves know, well, we were okay. I mean, like Ipswich, they weren't great in the first half. I keep coming back to this. They weren't great in the first half, but grew as the game went on. Now, if it'd been the other way around and we'd had a really good first half and taken our two goals and then just been quite poor in the second half, it's quite easy with the nature of the momentum to think, well, yeah, we weren't so good and we got over the line. But seeing as the direction of travel was to get better during the game, I think that's where confidence comes from.
Yeah. The good thing is, actually, in true Ashley Barnes style, Fabian did actually say after the United game, it was good to get the 9 points.
Yeah, he did.
Did he? Brilliant.
The other thing with this is also options, isn't it? And I think it was McKenna who mentioned Brighton had better options off the bench, better players they could bring on. And Hertzler, I thought, at Ipswich, managed his resources really well with the context of thinking about Old Trafford when he put players on or didn't put players on, who he took off. It worked within that game.
He has been criticised earlier in the season in some cases for some of his game management, for some of his substitutions. Now, personally, I think it's a little bit harsh because not every substitution will work well. You can bring someone on. I mean, obviously the Solly March thing came on, and I think that's another thing that gave everyone a boost. Not only was that a nice 4-0 win, it was seeing Solly March back, and that really sort of took people to, I think personally, to the next level, knowing full well. It's almost like having a new player come back. That's what I loved about it. I was so, I think every Brighton fan was so pleased for his return, for his goal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's not worry too much about the lack of VAR. But it was, it was so good to see. And he continued at Old Trafford.
The thing is with the substitutions, I think it's easier to make substitutions when you're losing than when you're winning, because if you make a substitution or change a game to, or change the team to change the course of the game, I think that's possibly easier to do than to make a substitution when things are going well. Changing things when they're not going so well is easier than changing things when they are going. And I think that Liverpool, they might have fallen into that trap of not making a change soon enough because things were going well. But if you look at Ipswich, he made the changes when things were going well.
Yeah.
So I mean, that it, might be a subtle difference. Fabian and the other got, games as well.
Fabian got absolute pelters after the Leicester game for bringing on Igor to close the game out. But I mean, that's you know, that's part and parcel of football management, bringing on a defender to see out a game.
He did exactly that at Newcastle, where he played five at the back. It wasn't Igor. I think he put Van Hecker on. And he was praised on another well-listened-to Albion podcast for putting five at the back and being clever and mature. And then he was accused of being scared late on at Leicester and putting too many defenders on. So I think that's...
Some people are so fickle.
Yeah, I think it's... Well, I think it's... but how many games have they had? So they've had... How many games is it? It's more than 20 now, isn't it? So
22,
but,
I think.
22, right.
22
so that's,
league games, yeah.
Yeah, so that's 110 decisions over substitutions. So how many either, and that decision might be who you put on or it might be not to use the substitute. But basically that's 110 decisions. There will be some that aren't right.
And I think, actually, he's certainly, if we're going to judge him by the nature of substitutions and that level of game management, I think he's certainly in the black rather than being in the red, certainly.
But you can go back to the to part one of the Man United double. In the first game of the season, when his changes won us the game.
Yeah, well, is it with the case that it was Pedro who scored the winner? He didn't start the game, did he? Is that the case?
I think Pedro did start the game, but it was Ruta that came on. And
you're quite right, yes. That was our first sighting of Jorginho Ruta. And he only played a cameo, and he played in a position that kind of Gruder is now, or even Marches. He wasn't an out-and-out winger. And in fact, it's actually quite rare to see our players go down to the byline these days. Or if they do, they'll try and beat their defender on the byline and then run it out for a goal kick, which is, you know, quite an interesting tactic.
It's true.
But he came on, and I thought there was something about him. There was a bit of hustle. It was his first game. He hadn't been training with the team for that long. There was a bit of hustle about him. There was a bit of strength. He looked confident. It was only a 10-minute cameo, but as you say, it was part of that cameo. There was a cameo that was part of the match-winning thing, and there was something about him. He didn't sort of like then hit the afterburners for the rest of it, but I think he's certainly become an Albion favourite now.
Well, first game of the season, Dingra, there was a few others. I remember in the first game of the season, there were substitutes he put on just as the tide was turning Brighton's way.
Yeah,
there are probably others. I can't sort of think of the top of my head now, but like I say, I just think when you're chasing a game, it's I don't know, maybe it isn't, but it seems to me it's easier to make changes when you want to change from bad to good.
Yeah.
From when you want to change from good to good. But yeah. Anyway, should we talk? Are we going to talk about
that? Yeah, let's move on to the weekend then. And whilst we were recording the show last week, Al, we got the news that Dennis Laura died.
Yes.
Basically that led to a little bit of trepidation for me going into, because obviously Dennis was such a massive legend at United and Manchester as a whole. And
well, both of them. Yeah.
And I just, with United being a bit in the doldrums at the moment, I thought it might, the crowd would be up for it and might give everybody a lift. But
it's the kind of thing it's the kind of thing you do get a bounce back from, where, you know, you are appreciating one of your own. But I mean, there must be something bittersweet about him, because obviously not only was he their favourite, won the Ballon d'Or, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's the famous back heel while he was wearing a sky blue shirt. So And you also have to consider how many of that 70,000 crowd are not from Guildford. So how many would remember him? So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting. I know, I know Brian's champion at the bit to sort of wax lyrical about the game, but it is something that Warren Aspinall said as the Albion's third goal went in was, well, the only people left are the football tourists because all the locals are clearing off.
Yeah, I don't know. You do. It's amazing how many people you see going up to a home game, a Man United home game, and a Liverpool home game, as you're heading north. There's quite a few motorway services I stopped at, but I heard that news while I was out on Friday. They interrupted the BBC, like the Friday evening football preview program, and you knew it was going to be some sort of serious news, and obviously didn't expect it to be that.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought, I think we were saying, Avi, that it could almost galvanize. Oh, this isn't very good news for Brighton. And I was so guilty about thinking that way. But then I thought, no, logically, it doesn't necessarily need to be. But it was actually, I then looked forward to going even more so because it was going to be a momentous day at Old Trafford. So it was sad news in a way, but equally, you know, him's a bit a person to be celebrated too, and I think people were making that point on the radio straight away. And I sort of look forward to it being a poignant occasion to be up there.
Yeah, a celebration of life rather than sort of commiserating. And let's face it, I mean, he stopped playing pretty much 50 years ago. That's not to say that means anything, but you know, people do appreciate and the vast majority of good football fans respect and appreciate history. It's what sometimes they go to a game for, the acknowledgement and appreciation of history of a club, of a player, of a time, of trophies, or whatever it might be. And Dennis Law touched the lives of a lot of people. I mean, Manchester United was one of the bigger clubs in Europe. It was kind of a new up-and-coming club. You have to bear in mind that on the European stage, the Hispanic countries had, or the Mediterranean countries had bossed the European Cup. It was only ever won by Spain or Portugal or Italy. And Celtic first won it in 1967 and then Manchester United in 1968. So that's sort of, it's taken 13 years for the trophy to move north. And it was a seismic event in Manchester United. Now, admittedly, Dennis Law didn't play in the semi-final or the final, but he was such a massive part of that Manchester United side that was able to get to the European Cup final. You know, they mark it as one of their own that they've got the statue of those three people, George Best, Dennis Law and Bobby Charlton. That is the triumvirate of greatness over Manchester United. And so his passing, like I say, his death now means he can go and join the other two in that triumvirate. And, you know, it is a sad day for football. And I think that football itself did come together very well to mark the passing of a genuine giant.
Well, he saw United, City and United, and he united England, Scotland, I heard somebody say. He went to Torino, didn't he? He was like a pioneer going to play European football. And also talking to you two, obviously, radio, football radio enthusiasts like myself, how I grew up knowing him was as the summariser on Radio 2, I guess it would have been.
Alongside doing Peter Jones.
The co-commentaries, yeah. So I don't remember him playing, but I remember him as a voice on the radio as well. So,
Just as a quick highlight to highlight his true nationality and his own personal identity, 30th of July 1966.
I know the answer.
England were playing West Germany. He went and played golf. And he really didn't want to know the score.
Like a true Scotsman that
absolutely.
He is.
Absolutely,
I applaud that.
Than supporting the team playing.
I mean the statue is the start of a bad joke though, isn't it? An English Irishman and a Scotsman.
Yeah, and, I know. But went on to greatness.
True. Okay, well the match itself then we saw return for Lewis Duncan, Danny Welbeck. Danny's been a big miss over the weeks he's been out, Brian, hasn't he?
I think as a focal point for attack, as a focus of that almost like the captain of the offensive unit, if you want to, it almost sounds like American football style there. But I think so. And I think Joao Pedro has really tried hard to be the number nine, both in role as well as shirt number, but it hasn't suited him. So many people have sort of mentioned that, and it's come when Evan Ferguson hasn't been around as well. But we were doing so much stuff about him not being about him being injury free and staying fit, and then unfortunately he did get that injury. But it just looked to me, and again, sending him on for those two outings, actually Norwich and Ipswich, and then sending Lewis Dunk on for the last half hour at Ipswich, it just looked inevitable that those two would start at Old Trafford.
And, I thought that they, against Ipswich, certainly by the time Lewis Dunk came on, now it's not to say Adam Webster did badly, he didn't, he was fine.
I did well.
But I thought Lewis Dunk coming on stabilised the whole thing. There was something, and I can't, it's unquantifiable. There's something that Lewis Dunk did that I thought just, it was almost like gave, looked like it gave everyone confidence. Everyone sort of, their shoulders went up a little bit. I don't know, there was something, it's just like the skipper's back in town kind of thing. Now, Lewis Dunk isn't necessarily in the form of his life. He's getting on, and I'm sure that, you know, he'll want to keep on going for as long as he can. And I think that Ernie Tug Wilson's record is still within his sights. Certainly, the next two above him, which is Norman Gall and Peter O'Sullivan, in terms of appearances for the Albion, they're very much within his sights and very easy, very doable by the end of this season. So there's longevity left in Lewis Dunk. But like I say, he's 33 now. Can he go on the way that Paolo Maldini did?
No, even as long as Bruno did. Much starting to creak, actually.
You can hear his knees sounding like he's building a shed.
I felt very sorry for Adam Webster, actually, because, I mean, we've said many times over the years about Adam that when he comes back into the side, it does quite often take him a while to get back up to temperature. But he's come straight back in and he's been brilliant.
When he came on against Arsenal, I thought he was superb.
Funny how you word that. Did you say temperature? Because he said, when I spoke to him, I specifically asked to speak to him at Norwich after the game, knowing that Ipswich was coming up. And he said he went on. I said, they put you in at the deep end, didn't they? Arsenal sent you into that. And he said, because it was so cold that day, he'd spent longer than normal warming up just to keep warm. Oh. So he felt absolutely ready to go in. And that was a difficult situation he was sent into. Arsenal probably didn't threaten quite as much as I expected to in that last 20 minutes. But yeah, he did really well. And he'll just be ready. It's just a sign. It shows you, doesn't it? You just have to be ready because you never quite know when that moment is going to come. But yeah, I thought he tidied them over really well. And Van Hecker, obviously, we know what he does.
Because it is the case that we've lost Igor for the rest of the season, isn't it?
And I think it's fairly obvious that they're looking for another centre-back, whether at this month or at the end of the season. But definitely that's a...
let's have Colwell back then.
Well, that ain't going to happen.
The Vitor Aish thing would have been really good. That's obviously a big disappointment, but he's gone elsewhere now.
Yeah, sure. It's a sign for City, isn't it? But okay, well, player...
Actually, if I can, before you carry on, AD, as to whether he's ready or not is another matter, but all I would say is Rory McConville is no slouch. Now, whether he's oven ready for the Premier League and to start a game and to be there all the time is one thing, but when he did come on... he looked quite comfortable. So there are options if it doesn't come off in January.
And then that might be handy if it's a busy week or something, even if it's just 20 minutes or whatever, when fatigue levels are growing. Even if he can come and do that, as he did at Norwich, that could be valuable. It was Ed Turns as well, wasn't it?
I was going to say, Ed's been in and around the squad again as well. Because, I mean, Ed Turns was meant to be the next one off the rank a couple of years ago, and it just didn't... I mean, he went on loan, which didn't really work for him, did it? And it's like, he's worked himself back into the reckoning again. So good luck to him on that one.
Semi-crocked.
Yeah, you might be talking about, again, being on the bench in the FA Cup fifth round or something like that. It might be worth it.
Yes, yeah, when that happens, not if, when. Yeah.
Yeah, we're coming to that. Anyway, okay, one player I've certainly been critical of this season is... Yankuba Minter. He's been blowing a little bit hot and cold for me, but on Sunday, I was blown away by him completely and utterly. I mean,
were you blown away hot or cold?
Very, very hot. Yeah. Very hot.
Mistral, was it?
It was just, I'm watching him and it's just his work rate in that game, front and back. I mean, some of those tackles he was making when he was tracking back were just absolutely sensational and setting up another attack. And obviously 5 minutes into the game, Brian, he opened the scoring.
I think that's a really strange one with his tracking back and his defensive work, because I actually got on the wrong wavelength with Danny Welbeck about this in pre-season, because he was being, it was the, was it BRAL they played in the friendly?
Yeah, it was.
And
yeah.
Who wasn't chased, their left wing back or left back was getting loads of space. And after the game, I spoke to Danny Welbeck and I said, oh, what about without the ball? What do you make? Because he'd done some really good stuff with the ball, scored two really nice goals in Japan. And he said, oh, he works so hard, doesn't he? He's really good, really impressed with that. And I thought, hold on. And he looked at me like, do you know what you're talking about? And it was just the distinctions. Pressurising their opposition defenders high up, he was really good. And if you remember, he won a penalty doing that at QPR in pre-season. But he didn't track back. So it was those two aspects. And I was obviously talking about he doesn't run back. And Danny Welbeck was thinking, he's an absolute menace to the defenders when they've got the ball at the back. So it's just the two aspects. And yeah, there was two or three, wasn't there, in the first half at Manchester United, yeah, where he did work and he got back. The other thing I quite liked about him at Norwich, and he did it again at United, was just getting his head up and using the ball well. Because I think his choice of options, for example, when he went on at Villa, was open to question. But when he there was one at Norwich where he just waited, attracted two defenders and gave the ball to Veltman, who crossed for the first goal. So he's really exciting. He really just a raw talent.
Yeah.
I spoke to him underneath the Stretford end in the little player interview area after the game. And he was sort of talking about that, how he sort of just talking to people like his elders, he says, people like Danny Welbeck and the
his
coach
elders.
And getting that's his words. His words were his elders. Yeah, so I think he's always been exciting, but it's just channeling it, isn't it? And
yeah.
I thought, yeah, that he almost, Anand almost saved that one, that first half. his cross was more precise than for the second goal than his finish for the first. But
well,
yeah,
we'll come to that bit in a minute. But I mean, I've always thought you can see that there's so much raw talent there, and it's waiting to come out. And you know. We're wrong to judge players quickly. I mean, we're all guilty of it. We'll do it. But it's like, I've always said there's been a bit of the Paolo one-shop about him, as in he doesn't know what he's going to do next. So how can the rest of his teammates be on the same wavelength?
Yeah, but one thing that I was going to say that I mentioned to him, I said, oh, do you remember, because it was leading up to Everton as well. And I said, good memories of the Everton game. You know, he set up the first goal of the season, him and Mitoma. And he said, oh, yeah, I did. But then I got concussed. And I said, well, yeah, actually he did. And that was chasing back, wasn't it? It was an ungainly challenge. But to be fair, in that first game of the season, he hurt himself by chasing back, trying to make a tackle in his own penalty area. So I think the it's all good intentions. So, yeah, and that's really what you need, and learning your lessons.
Well, yeah. This is it. I mean, it's the whole thing of Eddie Howe and the issues they have at Newcastle. Eddie Howe really not wanting to offload Minté because, you know, he was a work in progress up there. He's come down here. I mean, I think it's probably going too far to say he did it seamlessly, because, like I say, you had that Everton game, or half the Everton game. And then after that, that's where the whole sort of headless chicken thing comes from. You know, he gets into a good position. And once he's done that, is it a cross? Is he going to go back on his other foot? Is he going to go back to Veltman? Is he going to go back to Lamptey? Is he going to try and take his man on and then knock it out for the aforementioned goal kick? And at the moment, and it's not him, because I think it's a malaise across the team generally, is that I want to say this, and maybe it's across football as a whole, that I think one of the reasons why we see fewer crosses from deep or from wherever it might be is because the percentages is the defenders are going to deal with it. So that what they're looking to do is, rather than cross the ball in and hope a big number nine is going to lump himself on the end of it, that they're passing within the area, and it looks like they're always trying to walk the ball in. But all the while you've got the ball, then you're the one that's got a better chance of scoring, rather than just throwing it in there and seeing what happens. And I think the wingers do get a bit of grief for this. But then when there's four or five Albion players waiting in the box for him to finish his trickery, or he's buggering about and it's just not coming in, they're not going to show it publicly, but there must be that one or two of them just want to grab him by the lapels and say, get this bloody thing in, would you?
Well, I mean, actually, this is what I was saying, because over the last couple of weeks, actually at Norwich as well, I think Brian just alluded to that as well, he is being more incisive. He is being less hesitant, and he is doing everything a bit quicker. And he was getting to the byline and putting it back. And we got a goal from that on for Jorginho at Norwich.
Well, it really should have. The West Ham one wasn't that hit the post. I don't know how Mitoma obviously probably just didn't see the ball, but that could easily have been another match-winning contribution that he made. Yeah, I think when it was Hertzler's introductory press conference, and there was a few of the top men up on the stage, and David Weir was amongst them, and I think it was him who was asked about Minté, and it was, I can't remember his exact words, but it was almost like a longer term signing, one for the future. So I was really surprised at the impact he made in Japan. He scored those two really good goals, one in each game. He had such a good pre-season, so I think he really propelled himself then and didn't maintain it over a while. And that right wing spot seems to have gone to various players all
So
the time.
when you say that, when you say he's quote one for the future,
It
does
was.
that
It wasn't a quote, just to be sure, it wasn't a quote. It was, I'm sort of
it's
giving an
kind of the
indication of
inference.
what he was saying,
Sure.
but it's what I'm getting at is the impression we got was he hasn't been signed because he's going to be a star in the first team straight away. It was one, a sort of be patient with him, he'll take a while, which sounded absolutely right. And then all of a sudden in pre-season he exploded with these fantastic goals. He'd
Sure.
won the penalty at QPR, so I think he had a
Yeah.
bigger impact earlier than was being envisaged. So perhaps inevitably that's not going to be maintained.
Well, does that say to you, or
Yeah,
do you think that there's an inference that you can draw from that, that as Solly March returns to fitness and gets the start again, that the likes of Minté will be put back in the queue?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's going to be a while before Solly March is playing regular 90 minutes or best part of 90 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure, but what we've seen is, okay, Mitoma was the exception to that, but even he got taken out for a couple of games, is that over a season, these players do have fluctuating moments or periods of the season where they look fantastic for a while and then they'll just drop off a little bit.
Yeah.
But if Minté's coming off the bench, I don't think that's a bad thing either.
But I mean, yeah. I mean, you say Kuro. I mean, Cruz has been. He's been blowing a little bit hot and cold of late, and actually, his first touch had been eluding him for a couple of weeks. But he was certainly back on Sunday, and that firstly, that ball from Belaba was an absolute beauty. But Carew's first touch to bring it down to set it and then set it up for Nkuba.
The number of times we've seen Brighton players completely and utterly cock that up, belting the football too far ahead of Minté or going behind him, or we've seen that. We've also seen that run in behind a dozy fullback who wasn't paying attention. And if Belaba, and we've seen it with Estupiñán, we've seen it before with Dunk doing those quarterback passes. If they're on the same wavelength, then it's absolutely lethal. And once you've Mitoma's got 5 yards on you, that's it. It's good night, Vienna.
Well, it was a great start to the game, but we did get pegged back. Carlos Baleba was adjudged to have fouled Xerxes. Thoughts?
Well, I think actually it's probably more prudent to point out that in between the goal and their goal, we were mucking about a bit, Brian.
Yeah, I thought that was, well, even Hertzler said, I mean, that's probably the worst period of the game was between 1-0 and 1-1. Yeah, then the penalty, I mean, it got to a quite frantic period sitting in the stand. I don't know what it was like for anybody who was watching. Oh, no, not on TV. It wasn't on TV, was it? For
No, no.
anybody following the game by other means. But it felt like there was almost a frantic feel which developed out of very little. Man United's Ahmad's a bundle of energy, so he sets the tone for them. Xerxes was sort of quite energetic as well. And it just got to a period where they seemed to increase the intensity, the tempo, the crowd got into it. There was a couple of decisions which were correctly given in Brighton's favour, but were seen as being wrong. So then they were howling for everything. And it just sort of slightly fell out of control a little bit from the Brighton point of view. And that was encapsulated by how they conceded that penalty. And I think Man United got at the sort of scent in their nostrils that if they pressed well enough, Brighton could make a mistake. And Brighton did make a mistake. It
Yeah,
was just
you're
that period. It felt like it was just getting away. and something needed to reel it back in again. And what surprised me was that United didn't build on that, or were unable to build on it, or Brighton were good enough to actually reel it in and calm it down and control. Because I thought they ended the first half Brighton quite well.
Yeah, I think your question though was, AD, was should it have been a penalty? Yeah.
I'm maintaining that. I mean, Carlos shouldn't have had his arm where he did.
No.
But Xerxes made the most out of any contact that there was.
There was nothing that made Xerxes fall over, let's put it that way.
No, but if he'd been carrying a pint.
If he hadn't have done, he probably wouldn't have got the penalty, and that's the ludicrous thing about it. Belaba was on the wrong side of him. He did use his arm. Mm. Well, you know, enough that it should have been a foul. And let's put it this way. If the boot was on the other foot, we'd be screaming.
Oh, yeah,
murder.
Probably. Probably.
And but, it's a split-second decision for the player as well, isn't it? And when you look back, you might think Xerxes was uncertain enough that Belaba might have been able to prevent him scoring without fouling him.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's so easy to judge a half-a-second decision after watching a replay for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the third penalty that Carlos has conceded this season.
I think one was given against somebody else, maybe Ruter. Was it the Chelsea one when the player went between two players? And sorry, I'd have looked it up in a bit more detail if I'd have known. But I think they've given it as being against the other involved in that incident.
No, there was two others which were definitely Carlos.
Right.
Yeah.
Forrest, wasn't there? Was it Forrest?
I mean, that's the thing about him being such a tenacious player. I mean, there were a couple of times when Fernandes did get the better of him, and we're talking about that panicky period in between the two goals that Brian was talking about there, where Belaba was a little bit all over the place and not doing really what he could or should be doing, and taking control of not just our midfield but their midfield. And that's not to say he can be absolutely brilliant every single game, but you couldn't help thinking that once he got his clear walking yellow card, I think was it a yellow card he got for the penalty?
Yes,
it was. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not to say he was a walking red card, because he carried on for another sort of hour or so, but this is the part of his game that he still needs to sort out. He, as much as people and Glenn Murray's talked about him being better than Caicedo and better than Bissouma, I think he has the potential to be that. But for me, he's not there yet. He is still a little bit of a maniac. He's still a little bit of a roadrunner for me. But it'll get there. And those decisions, you know, the decisions they've got to make, he's got to make on behalf of himself, of the player he's playing, of the team, that will come. At the moment, I can't help thinking he's a little kid in a sweet shop running around playing very well, but just sometimes, you know, getting a little bit too excited.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he's still been our best player by country mile this season. So I'm not going to go.
Oh no! It's brilliant that we've got. Like, you know, off comes, you know, off goes Bissouma, in comes Caicedo, off goes Caicedo, in comes Belaba, off goes Belaba, in comes dip.
Well, who comes? Because I was just thinking then, I wonder what would have happened if Vifa had been on the bench. If you think back to Leicester, when Belaba got a yellow card just before half-time, they took him off at half-time and put Vifa on. And this occasion, they didn't... I mean, you wouldn't take him off, I suppose, after however many minutes that penalty was. But they didn't protect him for that second yellow card, as Hertzler said he should have done at Bournemouth, and as he did at Leicester. So...
Well, to be fair, the second yellow at Bournemouth was a joke.
Yeah, it was, but it was the first yellow. He said when he was on a yellow, should he have taken him off? And maybe that's hindsight, but he did then do that at Leicester, and the only reason he took him off at half-time was, well, two reasons. One, because he was on a yellow card, and two, because he was able to put Mats Vifa on instead. Mm-hmm. And on this occasion, assuming he didn't want to put Diogo Gomes on for 45 minutes or 30 minutes just yet, you know, if he'd have had Vifa there... Would he have gone on for Belaba because of the yellow card? But anyway, Belaba came through it fine. It was, he committed one foul, I think, in the second half.
Right.
It wasn't a yellow card, so.
Yeah. Right, I want to talk about disallowed goals. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. We are in your ears thanks to the brilliant Flowers Unlimited, Alan.
Blouse Unlimited, 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove. That's Portland Road, Hove. Hove is Portland Road. You can get your flowers there for any purpose. Hey, what we've got coming up, chaps, in 3 weeks' time is Valentine's Day, and not a day that we can massacre Crystal Palace. What a shame. But if any of your floral requirements, do head over to Dave Costa's shop. If you're an Albion fan, you automatically get a 20% discount. Obviously, you have to tell them you're an Albion fan when you're when you're ordering. Yes, do head over there. Thanks very much indeed to Dave for sponsoring the show. The Flowers Unlimited are the official flower supplier to Brighton and Hove Albion. That's both at Lancing and at the stadium. And at the foundation, for that matter, I think, as well. So, yeah, head over to Flowers Unlimited for all your floral needs. Which is basically better than going, you know, through cemeteries and local parks with a pair of secateurs. Don't do that. That's naughty. So head to 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove, instead, and tell them we sent you.
I mean, surely, Alan, you're not suggesting that people might want to apologise to their wives and girlfriends and partners for, going to support the Albion at the Amex on Valentine's Day rather than spending time with them. Yes. Anyway, moving swiftly on, I want to talk about disallowed goals, Al. And I'm still angry. I'm saying VAR have cocked this one up. I'm saying it should have stood.
The letter of the law says it was a foul, but you're okay with that, provided you see that every single one of these is also given. And I'm sounding like an Arsenal whataboutery fan here. Yes, he did kick him, didn't get the ball.
Gets given as a foul anywhere else on the pitch. You can have contact without it being a foul.
I think you're right, AD, because the one thing about that is I watched Match of the Day and the commentator said anywhere else on the pitch, that's a foul. I thought, no, it's the opposite. Anywhere else on the pitch, that is not a foul. Nobody even notices it. It doesn't go to VAR. It's not subject of slow-mo and close-up.
Well, it wasn't given as a foul at the time, and that's the point, isn't it? And because VAR got involved, it was given as one.
It's because he crumpled to the floor as if he'd been shot, which the contact didn't merit.
I think it's one of those letter of the law, it's a foul. All of our footballing barometers say that doesn't look like a foul. We sort of have an idea what a foul looks like, what a red card looks like.
Yeah. If VAR was to look at every single tackle, of course it can't, and that would be ridiculous. Unless hypothetically to administer a judgment within half a second as to yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. In the middle of the pitch, that would be given as a foul. The only reason it isn't is because it's not checked or not seen. I'll say the referee didn't see it. His on-field decision was goal. So that's the only reason it's not given anywhere else is because no one sees it.
Well, it happens everywhere on the pitch.
That's what I'm saying. It happens on the pitch, but just not seen.
Yeah, and it's not given.
You can't give it if you don't see it. And the referee wasn't going to give it until such time as VAR did. And those are the things that VAR is there for, is to check whether there's a, let's say, letter of the law. It's the correct decision.
The law is an Arsenal fan. In that case,
see what you did there. Not bad. But can I just say that the only thing I would say about this, and maybe you can answer this, Brian, is that because Pedro has been playing with a little bit, it seems to be, with stoop shoulders, and those stoop shoulders seem to have a chip on them. He's been a lucky boy a couple of recent games. But did the fact that even though it was disallowed, did him scoring that goal? Do you know? Did it give him a boost?
No idea, but it was a really good finish, wasn't it? It was maybe he's trying to be the sort of the warrior up front and have that physical edge and that physical sort of resilience. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure about that. But I suppose that maybe a goal or two will help him to rediscover his sort of happy edge, his mojo. Yeah, but I think it was sort of overlooked. What a terrible free kick it was, which I think distracted people. And I don't know what it is with Ayari. Some of he's played so well and some really nice passes.
His second against Ipswich was a terrible free kick.
The cross for the third goal. So it's almost like a Midas touch, isn't it? But it was a really good finish. And what I really liked about that moment was I thought it was really harsh and I could see why it was disallowed. Sort of box ticking sort of thing, but it didn't feel like it was a foul. And like you say, if the player hadn't gone down, it wouldn't have been noticed. But I just felt rather than taking it as a tie-turning moment or a setback, Brighton actually seemed to grow from it. And I think after that, João Pedro actually went to the crowd, the away fans, and sort of, although it annoys me sometimes how they try and G the crowd up with the waving, on this occasion it was probably quite timely, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Yeah.
But they took strength from that moment, which could have been a turning point in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Well, justice was done, Brian. Justice, I tell you. And it was Kuruma Toma who became the record Japanese goal scorer in the Premier League with that goal. But as good as the goal was, it was all about that ball from Minter, and it was just sensational.
Well, it was partly about that run by Ayari, and it was partly about that advantage from the referee. But it was a lot about, and it was partly about the keeper not coming out to claim that cross. But it was a lot about so many things it was about. But it was, it was partly about Mitoma's strength.
You know how much you sound like Andy Gray and Richard Keys.
It was partly about Mitoma's strength and desire to get there.
It went in the back of the net. That's all I care about.
Yeah, it went in from via Mitoma, wasn't it? And the record that he says himself he should have had ages ago.
Yeah,
finally has.
Fair enough. The other thing about it is, I mean, obviously one doesn't indulge in too much Schadenfreude, but the way the defender absolutely sort of whacked himself against the goalpost in trying to defend it. I mean, it wasn't quite a Phil Babb moment, because that was between the legs trying to stop a goal going in. This was kind of a midriff one. But Christ, he gave that goalpost a wallop.
Yeah, I actually made a mental note of his name at the Amex. I thought he did a good job on Mitoma, kept him quite quiet in that game.
Yeah.
But he was just, Mitoma was just too strong, and, you know, it was almost a centre-forward's goal, wasn't it?
He mentioned
Andy Gray, I could imagine, after they'd have headed it, but it was that sort of desire and strength to get there.
Well, we've seen him score that goal, that kind of goal before. I mean, it's only 15, but there's at least a couple of others that I can think of where he has just gone piling into the back post, stuck his leg out.
Mm.
I mean, there's a couple of times where he stuck his leg out and it's gone the wrong side of the post. But so we've seen that goal before. He is what do they used to call it? Alan Clark. He's a sniffer's goal.
Mm. Yeah. Just getting in those areas, isn't it? The far post, not staying on the wing. Yeah. And yeah, that was that then, wasn't it? That was there was no stopping them this time. Yeah. They didn't let it slip on this occasion.
Brian, have you heard that goal's gone down in Japan?
No, I haven't. But what I do know is that it's close season on the J-League, close season on the baseball. And I wrote a piece about 2 months ago, a long piece, which hopefully will have decent fee for it. And it's been on hold. And I had the WhatsApp. I know I sort of told you before we came on here, just before I was about to set up, having finished work a little bit early, I've had messages and WhatsApps and things. And one to do with Paraguay and Tractor Boys. And one was from this bloke in Japan saying, we're running your piece. I've translated it into, I wrote it in English, obviously, and he sort of edited a little bit and he showed me what he'd come up with. So I assume that's a good indication that it's reignited a bit of Mitoma mania at this time of year, which was the time of year when he scored against Liverpool 2 years ago in the FA Cup.
Sure.
I know what you mean. You can score, you know, he scores goals against Bournemouth and he can score at Ipswich, and it's not going to cause massive excitement around the
ramen
and noodle bars of Tokyo. But if you score against Manchester United, that's different, and the record as well is different.
Goal and an assist.
Yes, that's somebody pointed out to me, one of the Japanese reporters, straight away. Goal and assist. You think he was man of the match? No, he came up to me and he said, "Man of the match today." And I said, "Baleba," and it was a little bit mischievous. But he said, "Goal and assist. Goal and assist." I think he's only ever done that once before in the Premier League.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, so yes, the record might have been enough, but the fact he scored against Manchester United, so we'll see. But I'm taking the indication that they're running this piece that I wrote about 2 or 3 months ago. They're finally going to use it. It's a good indication of the excitement about him scoring that goal.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Mitomania is real, and we'll be back at the Amex.
But more importantly, Brian is, as Alphaville once sang, Back big in Japan.
Yeah, no, that's quite strange, isn't it? Brighton are huge in Japan. Yeah. But yes, that was... Yeah, but I was quite pleased for him as well, because he obviously got left out of the team for a couple of games, and Hertzler said a couple of things about him not playing, which I only sort of picked up on when I listened back to the press conference about players always have to be good in training, and players, just little things which you think, oh, hold on, was he sending a little message about Mitoma there? Not quite sure. But what I like about him as well, right at the end, I think it's underrated, his defensive diligence and his willingness to get back. And right at the end, one of the United players got to the byline and Mitoma was back there to turn the ball behind for a corner. So he does that side of his game. And one of the Norwich reporters who I sort of heard from a little bit up there of the cup game, so they were surprised how physically strong he was. They thought he'd be a slight, you know, a little small, lightweight character. And although I didn't think he played that well at Norwich, they were quite impressed by his physical presence and that as well. So
he's not one of those that can hold the ball up when he's got a lumbering, great big centre half. Or a big right back behind it. When the ball's, you know, it's that kind of, can you hold the ball up and then lay it off? He's not that kind of player. So in that sense, he is slight. But yeah, once he gets going, you cannot knock him off the ball. Looking at that brilliant goal, he's probably his best goal, the one against Wolves, where, you know, he cut him from, what, 40 yards out. A couple of Wolves players tried to take his shirt off and he still went through all of them. That is not the sign of someone who's, you know, sort of weak.
No,
he bustled his way through there.
Yeah. Just one thing about Mitoma, I just think we judge him by standards which are higher than we judge other players. I can remember years ago, very early on, Bruno setting up two goals against Sheffield Wednesday with two fantastic assists.
Yeah.
And he seemed to be judged for a long time on that game. Yeah. And it was always like, oh, he's not back to his best, or now he looks like he's getting back to his best. And with Mitoma, I think as well, he did brilliant things early on and he's set a bar so high that I just think if he makes sort of two or three dangerous runs and does his defensive work and is involved in some chances, that's not enough. I think sometimes we expect, not miracles, not quite the right word, but sort of wonders from him.
Well, one of the things that makes Mitoma the difference between looking good and looking great is the form of Purvis Estupiñán. Once upon a time, and we're probably looking at sometime last season, maybe season before, once those two were cooking, they were unplayable. And it does require both of them to be on form. And I can't help feeling that sometimes, and I think, again, Hertzler has made a point of saying this, he's a bit worried about Estupiñán's positioning at times. And we've been caught out at least, you know, sort of once or twice recently on this. So there's something that Estupiñán himself has to learn by the sound of things. But having said that, going forwards, they do still have that kind of build-up, that understanding, but there's a little bit of the, back to that word, unquantifiable, that little bit of magic that's just missing at the moment. But when it does happen, and it does happen now and again, like I say, they're unplayable. But I think that Mitoma is made to look all the better when Estupiñán's on form.
But I also think Estupiñán's not totally appreciated in some ways in how he gets in some of these little touches just to take the ball and keep it away from an opponent, or how he tucks into midfield and helps out there. Or there was one occasion at Ipswich where he was it the Ipswich game where he was the centre forward when a cross came in, and he does get caught out. You're right that players do get in behind him, and you can track back goals to opposition players in behind that left side. And whether is that because he's been out of position or he's been doing what he's told, I'm not quite sure. Hertzler did say in the first half at Ipswich he thought he was in the wrong, his positioning wasn't quite right. Oh, that was on TNT, wasn't it? He said that it wasn't.
I think he was out of position for the Arsenal goal down here recently.
Yeah, but I just think also that he sort of gets involved in midfield and gets involved in a lot of different areas, which are perhaps... I watched the Ipswich game back, having watched it in the stadium, and three things that struck me were, it looked a better game in the stadium than it did on TV. Van Hecker looked better in the stadium than it did on TV. And that's maybe because I was surrounded by all these people willing the lap on to cause him a physical challenge, should we say. And Estupiñán, I noticed things on TV that I didn't so much notice in the game. Little details, just little bits and pieces. So that was just... But yeah, Hertzler has spoken, hasn't he, about the link between Estupiñán and Mitoma and how that's been developed over time. And he hasn't been able to develop other partnerships in other areas of the pitch. do wonder if Baleba and Ayari is developing quite nicely.
They think so, don't they?
It needs to.
Yassin's come out this week and he said that he's building a really good relationship with Baleba now. I mean, I know you've been critical of Yassin over the last few weeks.
Well, he's lousy at the dead ball. I think we've just ascertained that already.
He might be lousy at it, but it ends in goals. Maybe it's a design flaw by default.
Maybe the worse the free kick, the more likely it is to go in. Forget your Pascal Gross landing on a sixpence stuff. But yeah, it is bizarre how probably two of the most as is pointed out. Let's talk about the moment that Warren Aspinall referred to the Man United keeper as Zebedee hands.
I did like there was a brilliant quote I saw that the owner of Man United couldn't make it today. He's currently playing for Dortmund, and which I very much enjoyed.
I saw that Ipswich fan who's on either Instagram or TikTok going on about Ipswich. He carries some mustard in his pocket going on about East Anglia is still blue and white, and I did think then, well, it is blue and white, but not quite in the way that you mean.
But if
you're talking about the third goal, just to mention before we forget of Solly March's first touch.
Oh, yes. Beautiful.
To lead to that. But yeah, go on. You're talking.
Yeah, well, not the world's greatest cross. I can't help feeling there's a touch of hit and hope about it. It was nowhere near Ruta. I mean, to be fair, it's nowhere near the keeper, but it was almost sort of like to no man's land.
Yeah. A Brighton goalkeeper did actually do something very similar this weekend, actually.
Was that Beadle's in?
Yeah, Beadle.
Yeah.
Sheffield Wednesday against Leeds. He spilt one that ended up in a goal similar to Jorginho's. But it was, a fourth goal in the week for Georgie. And, you know, a smile that lit up the stadium again. It's just fun, isn't he?
Yeah, and I thought he would, in my predicted lineup, that was the one that I got wrong because I thought he would start with his, just sort of ride that form that he's in. And when you think he got that whack, didn't he, scoring the second goal at Norwich? But maybe should have had another. I listened back on to the radio commentary and they were saying that he should have had another late on when there was that confused incident with, I think, Matoma involved. But no, he is fun and he did have a little lull and was taken out of the side. And that's, again, what we were talking about earlier. Players will sort of have dips and they'll come back reinvigorated.
Have you interviewed him yet?
Yeah, a few times, yeah.
And is he the sort of like the fun yeah, guy that he comes across?
He is. I spoke to him at Newcastle. That was it. One of the locals said something about, oh, is it good to go away, have it with the win ugly? You know, is it good to win ugly? Because I know Brighton were hanging on a little bit at the times in that game. And he said, it wasn't ugly. You think it was ugly? I know. I don't think it was ugly. And it was beautiful and 1-0. And he was quite sort of, but he was doing it in quite a jokey way. And he's spoken about his horse racing interests. And so I've probably spoken to him probably three times. The only thing is, when he's the scoring the goals, and so he's on Match of the Day, international TV, all sorts of other broadcasts, we don't necessarily then get to talk to somebody who's already done sort of five interviews. So that was one at Newcastle when I spoke to him where he'd been involved in the goal for Danny Welbeck, but certainly he'd played really well from a defensive point of view as well. So, yeah, he's fun to talk to. He usually ends up in sort of laughs and giggles and smiles, but he was good. By the way, Minto was really good to talk to as well, and you'll see a piece with him on the website of the newspaper. So he was really good to talk to at Man United.
Well, amazingly, that's all we've got time for. So we will have to talk about Jakob Moda next week. But then the window will have closed by then, so we'll have a better picture about what's going on. But for now, thank you very much to Brian Owen. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham, and this has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, of course on a podcast, and in association with Flowers Unlimited. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye. Don't know what
brown under moonlit sky. I want my love, my joy, my left, my smile, my knees. Not in the star signs or the palm that you raise. I want my sun-drenched, windswept, Ingrid Bergman kiss. Not in the next life. I want it in this, I want it in this. Got one note to last all week, I'll carry on regardless. The hill to happiness is far too steep, I'll carry on regardless. Dried his mouth in the Memphis sun, he carried on regardless. Tried to smile and he bit his tongue, but carried on regardless. Carry on with work, carry on with love, carry on with cheering and a thin above. I want my love, my joy, my left, my smile, my knees. Sun-drenched, windswept, Ingrid Bergman kiss. Not in the next life. I'll have it in this. I'll have it in this. I don't want silver. I just want gold. Carry on regardless. Bronze is for the sick and the old, but carry on regardless.